And it's Steve Tasker who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy.
All right, here we are, day one post-draft. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker, One Bills Live, and joined in studio by Bills General Manager Brandon Bean, who's barely had a chance to exhale after the close of the draft. You had Sunday, I guess, but you're still picking up loose ends, I would think. You guys are kind of reviewing stuff. And do you, that brings me to my first question, Brandon, because there is a review process to everything that went down as well, right? You guys will comb through the draft and maybe kind of compare and contrast it to your board, maybe not just your, not your picks, but everybody else's, right? There is some element of review to that, right?
Yeah, we definitely – we track the board. We have the magnets up there, but we write in where they go, and we leave it up there for a little bit just to look and see. And, you know, we definitely use history for positions, and corner was obviously one going back to – we spent, you know, the last couple of weeks in, when we got into corner conversations talking about – because we said coming in this draft, first few rounds, we'd like to get one. Because you get lower in there, you're going, how much can you count on them year one? And we knew we wanted to have somebody year one. Mm-hmm. So we really started looking and kind of going through the names of the last three or four drafts where these guys were going. We had done a similar thing when I was in Carolina when we were looking for corners. And one year we won them, and they all went. And we're like, man, we might be grading them too hard. Like when every time we're getting up. And that a little bit last year, we felt like that was happening. Like – maybe we're grading them too hard, or people are just like receivers. They're scared they're not going to be there. So there's these run on them. And I think you saw that again at corner. Nine in the first two rounds for corner.
Yeah. Certainly in Kaiir Elam, you got a guy that has every bit the look that he can be there week one.
Yeah.
Got a chance to look at the embedded and saw the interview process when he is like, yeah, splattered, like McDermott had to be going, you know what, this is the guy, right? I mean, how, right? I mean, just raise his hand in the middle of the interview, yeah, going, you know, as soon as you stop, you know what, we're going to take you. So just if you're there, you're because it really does seem like he's got that DNA, said all the right words, and maybe he's got a good agent that coached him up, but it really seems genuine.
No, you know, you do have to say, all right, is this authentic? Is this my 15 minutes to make you think I'm like this, but I'm really like this? Listen, those were true notes. Those were notes that he had broken down of, you know, some receivers and stuff like that, the SEC guys he was going against, and it was his legit, you know, it was all wrinkled up and been to hell and back. But that's who he is. That's who the person is at Florida that matches the sources. That's not a made-up deal. And you can just tell the more you're around, and we brought him for a 30 visit. You know, his wiring reminds me a lot of Tre'Davious. Just wants to be a sponge, wants to be great. Obviously, he's got the pedigree with his dad and his uncle. But you know what? There more and more kids are really impressive in some of those. There, you know, some other ones that did not end up being Buffalo Bills in their own way that did some similar things that we were like, okay, very impressive.
Right. Night one, I know when we had you in here last week, you hoped quarterbacks would go, knowing it would push the other talent down the board to you. That didn't really happen. But the receiver run started at 8, mm-hmm, and then there's three trades to take receivers between 11 and 13. And I know you've probably seen a lot of things in your years of being in draft rooms, Brandon, but I'm sitting there going, what the heck is going to happen next? It was like a frenzy for receivers. I know you told us you traded up because you only had really one player left with a first-round grade to take Kaiir, but what kind of impact does a run like that on receiver have on your thinking, besides value at receiver's gone? I mean, that was obvious, but how does that impact your thinking as it's coming down to you seeing that kind of activity?
Yeah, I mean, it continued with some trades of A.J. Brown.
Yeah, at 18.
Yeah, so right. It was definitely people probably going, okay, maybe Philly said, hey, well, if we like a receiver there, I'm assuming, if we like a receiver there, we may take him. But if not, we got something in the works here with Tennessee. We'll go to that plan, and then Baltimore and Arizona with Hollywood Brown. So there was a lot going on. You start to make you wonder how many other deals are about to pop in. But you know, we had positions, you know, players on both sides of the ball. But it was definitely getting cleaned out. My biggest concern was when these quarterbacks were going to go, and finally at 20. We got one. And then at 21, it was like, uh-oh, we're about to go back to corners. Kansas City trades and takes McDuffie. We got one guy left. Let's be aggressive. And we couldn't work it out with Green Bay, but we worked it out with Baltimore.
And was it a surprise to you to see how many, the 9 draft day trades in the first round? I mean,
that's a ton.
Yeah, well, they were one of them.
Yeah.
Right.
It seems to be the way to go. You have some targets, you have some things you want to come out with. And I think, like anything, there were some guys that people felt really could make an impact this year. And so I think that's where you saw the aggressiveness mm-hmm. in round one going, okay, if we don't do it, as we go down, I don't know how impactful this player will be this year. Part of our thinking, even with cornerback as well.
Right.
Where can we slide to and say this player in round two can definitely, help us this year?
I feel comfortable. I don't always speak for Steve, but I feel comfortable saying this. So for Steve and I, James Cook was probably our favorite pick of the whole dang draft. So we're on the show Friday afternoon before night two, and we're talking about, like, hey, what could be on the board for the Bills, this, that, and the other.
We thought it was going to be, at 57.
Near the bottom of round two, though, we didn't think there was going to be any value for you guys at receiver because whoever didn't get one night one was going to be taking them at the top of the round in round two.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, that happened. Another 7 guys go off before your original pick at 57.
Yeah.
And so we were saying, well, how can you still diversify the pass game? And we were like, that kid Cook looks pretty good. And, I mean, we didn't know what the value was in your room or anybody else's, but we're like, well, that guy could still diversify a pass game for you, even though he's not listed as a receiver. And then sure enough, you guys take him. And we're like, woo, we're whooping it up in here. But he can really diversify your pass game, can he?
That's really what it is. What we were looking for this weekend, in no particular order, was adding some pieces to the passing game, run after catch, mismatch ability, and that could be at a receiver, that could be at a tight end, and in this case was a running back. But this is a guy you're gonna try to get the ball in his hands in space, whether that's hand it to him in a wide zone, line him out of receiver, running him in a screen. Like, there's just various ways to get the ball in his hand, and we're excited about what he does with it in his hand.
Do you sense a trend of guys like that? We've talked last year and a year or two ago for the last couple of years on the defensive side, getting these hybrid guys that are, athletes. You know, can rush the passer, they can cover guys, and they can tackle and whatever. Is there a trend on the offensive side of the ball about guys like a Deebo Samuel, like Isaiah McKenzie a little bit, mm-hmm. guys you can hand it to, line up in the backfield, and also split out wide? Is there kind of a trend going towards that for a guy like James Cook?
Yeah, I think what you're trying to do is you're trying to get the defense into a defense where you got an advantage.
Right.
And how do they – okay, if you go out there with two tight ends, how are they playing you? Are they playing you like you're running the ball, or are they just using those as two more receivers? Like, so you're looking at now at this point, adding him, if we go with Motor or Moss in the game with him, what defense are we getting versus just him in the game? This just gives – if we go with two tight ends in the game and this kid – like, that's what really – you're looking for how people will play you. And I know last year at times Dable was using Reggie Gilliam a lot just because what defense we were getting, which he thought gave us some advantages. So, to me, it's a mismatch piece that we can use – lined up in the backfield, lined up split out, and just different ways to get him the ball and hopefully get him on a linebacker that we think he's going to have an advantage.
Yeah, you put him out there in 22 personnel. It's not necessarily a power formation because you can throw it to him and, split him out or send him. I mean, there are multitude of options there. It's pretty attractive. Terrell Bernard, right away I can see this kid being a special teams cover demon for you guys on teams. But he seems like a linebacker where – as long as you can keep him clean, you got good DTs. If you can keep him clean, he's going to get you 100 tackles without breaking a sweat.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. He's a linebacker first. We do think he'll be able to help us on fourth down. But, we lost A.J. Klein. He's been a great fit for us the last couple of years. But the salary cap, it is what it is, and we had to make some tough decisions. And so adding a guy with his smarts and his versatility to play inside and play outside, he's a playmaker. Like, you want to knock his size. Tasker got his size knocked, too. He belongs in the Hall of Fame. And, hopefully this kid – will be a heck of a player. He knows how to play the game. He's a slippery blitzer. When you watch him, he knows how to do it. He's instinctive. He's smart. guys like him make up for their lack of prototype size with all the other things, his preparation, his instincts, his quick twitch. You know, in the box, he's got range, you know. So we feel like, you're right, that if our guys are holding up in there, that he's going to be able to run and chase and make plays.
Yeah, we were worried, too. We thought, too, and you look deeper into Bernard, had some trouble sometimes staying on the field. To me, some guys like that who are maybe a little undersized, it's because they play a little reckless. You see his highlights. I mean, he's not afraid to stick his nose in it. I mean, for undersized guys, sometimes self-preservation is an issue.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, he'll definitely have to learn how to how we tackle and what we expect and keeping himself healthy. But he's a tough kid, and, you know, our medical people felt really good with him. You know, a lot of these guys come out and they've had nicks here and there. But we think he'll be a good fit here and again, give us some versatility as an inside-outside guy.
I know when I asked you on Saturday, you know, do you put Shakir in the run-after-catch column as well? You said yes. The thing about him is, while he has that first-step quickness off the line, he's got these hesitation moves at the top of the right. He just leaves people in the dust as far as separation. I know he ran in the low 4.4s, but there's a craftiness to his route running, which seems pretty advanced for a young player just coming into the league, right? I mean, especially for like a fifth round pick, like he's crafty.
Yeah, he's a really good football player. That's what he is. He's not small, but he's not big. He's just right in the middle. He's just under 6 foot. He's 196 pounds. He's good with the ball in his hands. He's got some speed once he's up and running. We do think he can help us with the rack. We love his versatility. Similar to when we got Gabe, different size still. But, you know, when we brought Gabe in, we're like, man, this kid's smart and can play multiple spots. We like that about Shakir.
He's got this body. He's making – you got to watch the highlights. He's making one-handed catches.
Yeah, one of the things, too, is he catches really well. He's got amazing body control, great hands, a little bit like Cole Beasley. Cole makes some catches that really look hard to make, and he makes them consistently. This guy, same thing. He doesn't – ball doesn't get on the ground when you throw it to him. And I think that's – I mean – we used to laugh, can he catch the ball as a guy you're going to throw the football to?
It's called receiving.
Exactly. Exactly. Sometimes that gets lost in the – you know, you get their 40 time, their vertical, their broad jump. If he can catch, it's not just a plus. It's kind of core value, right?
Yeah, you kind of need to do that.
But he does that really, really well.
He does it well. The drops he had were generally concentration drops. He had some, but to what Brownie was alluding to a while ago, he had some really, body control, one hand along the sideline. He made some spectacular catches. He's got ball skills.
He's doing 180s and, like, backhanded. There was some highlight reel stuff.
Yeah, there's some ridiculous stuff.
At his pre-draft press conference week before the draft, Coach McDermott was asked about adding speed at receiver. Coach said he believed they already had good team speed, but that you never turn it down.
Yeah.
The top three skill position players you drafted, Elam, Cook, Shakir, 4.39, 4.42, 4.43 at the NFL Combine. Obviously, it's not the only part of a prospect's skill set. It doesn't hurt, right? I mean, you added some juice here.
Yeah. You're always looking for speed. Any position you're talking about. Linebacker, we just talked about with Bernard. Mm-hmm. Even a lineman, you're looking for his speed to get out on a pull or a screen, whatever.
Right.
So you're always looking to add speed, but not at the expense of being a good football player.
Right.
And speed without instincts doesn't equal that. They don't play as fast.
Right.
So I would say all three of these guys are very instinctive players, and you see their speed match up.
What's the first we can expect to see these guys like out here running around? I mean, I know that, you know, they've already been in town. When's the last one of these guys arrive, or has he arrived already?
So we only bring in the Thursday night pick and the two Friday.
Right.
Other than that, just in case some have class or whatever. So we'll bring them in a week from Thursday. We'll have our rookie camp. It'll end up being kind of 2 days just so that we don't wear them out, because they'll stay and join the vets after that.
Yeah, rookie mini camps are extra week back, pushed it back a week, because usually it's that first week right after the draft, so it's the following week. Stay away from Mother's Day. Don't make any moms mad the first time they got to go to work.
the reason we started doing two, we've done it most recently, but and we did it 2 weeks after last year, is because if you bring them in the first week, you got to turn around and fly them all home.
Yeah.
And turn around and fly them all back in with air travel and all the, you know, this isn't the easiest place in the world to get to. It's much easier to bring them in one time and keep them.
One more thing on Shakir. Your biggest move was in that round. You go up 20 spots for Shakir. You don't make a move like that unless you really – someone's really sticking out on your board. Was he essentially there by himself to make that move?
Yeah, he was. When we got to pick 130 that I traded to Baltimore to move up for Elam, I looked at the board, and it's just – a habit of mine, really, usually just to piss myself off and say,
"We had that pick.
Could have had that pick."
Yeah, yeah, right.
Got antsy and traded up. Now I knew all along I would do that, but when pick 130 came up, he would have been the guy. And so when it got to the fifth round, I had had some conversations with Jeff King, former tight end who used to play for us in Carolina. He's now in the Bears front office, and had talked to him in the morning. He had called and said they were looking to acquire, you know, more picks, and would we be willing to move one of our six to move up at some point? Mm. And I said, do me a favor, call me at the beginning of the fifth. Let me see what's on the board after four, and we'll decide. And I said, hey, there's a guy I like. If he's still there, we'll get this done.
Nice.
Right. Yeah.
You always say your team doesn't play a game until September, so you're always working on the roster. This is the time of year – I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but this is the time of year when – teams may throw some vets overboard depending on what they got in the draft, and we've seen a little of that already around the league. But will your cap situation allow you to kind of keep looking if you feel there's a vet or two that can help you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the cap is still an issue. We have to be mindful because, you know, even where our cap number sits, that's our top 51. Mm-hmm. If you just sit here and look and you do some early roster projections of where – we need more money to get into the regular season. Okay. So it's not like if we were cutting it down right now based on, you know, certain criteria, not knowing how it's going to play out, if you were just doing a guess of roughly some of the ways it could break down, you know, we need another $3 or $4 million for that. Right. And then you got replacement costs, guys that get injured between now and that time, or even in season.
Yeah, you want a cushion.
You need to save. So you're always trying to save $5-6 million going into that. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a lot of flexibility, but yes, we'll still be out there looking for some vets. Hopefully they're at our price.
If is there anything, if you look back at this draft, and I know you just did, you told us you did your review. Was there, you don't have to tell us what it was, I guess, but was there most like, you know, if, you know, it's easy to do it after the fact.
Yeah.
Is there some of that stuff, if I had known?
Yeah, there's always, and that's the if I had known, I worry more about at the top of the draft versus the bottom. And that is why I traded up for Kyer, because I didn't want to say, because I really wasn't necessarily worried about those two teams, but I was just worried about someone knowing our desire for a corner to trade in front of us was my biggest concern. And you just can't predict that. And I wanted to sleep as good as I could that night and know we're right here. We're a couple of picks away. We really like this guy. He fits us. I'll figure out the fourth round later, and we'll take this guy.
Right.
With a quarterback class that didn't deliver in the draft in terms of storylines, if you're sitting in our seats and you need a headline for this year's draft, is it receivers or is it pass rushers, do you think?
I mean, that run on receivers was interesting. And I think to what we were talking about earlier, the run on receivers and then, okay, there's nobody left that I think can impact me the way I want. I'm going to get A.J. Brown or Hollywood Brown. That was interesting. Just the narrative from a player standpoint of this offseason is where the receiver market is gone. You've seen that either through frustration of contracts or through pay raises like we gave Steph Diggs to the six in a row and then two teams trading first-round picks plus to get a guy.
Yeah, the fact that 10 minutes later, A.J. Brown had a five-year, $100 million extension that.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, maybe this was in the works for a little while.
Yeah.
And you got it. In hindsight, you also get a look at, and you had mentioned in your post-draft that, you know, Elam was kind of your last number one that you had on your board. And as you look at it and look at the other teams, particularly in the AFC East, what they, and I guess, yeah, I don't know what New England was doing, but their line for their number one picks was different than the Bills, it mm-hmm. seems like.
Particularly like everybody else.
And everybody else, right. But also the other teams, everybody's line about who's number one and who's not is similar but different.
It's definitely different.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you
that's
talk,
the interesting part about the entire process.
I may have 15 first-round grades, and you may have 19. And,
right.
But it can be a tick, though. I may have a guy right below, just very top of two. I may have some guys right there that I'm going, there's one thing that's keeping me from saying, because first round, he's got to hit a lot of things. He's got to have, as you know, very few holes. You're trying to eliminate the bust factor.
Sure.
And you know what? There's something there holding me back. Sometimes it can be medical, but sometimes it can be character. Sometimes it can be smarts. Something tells me I got to be a little bit concerned, as talented as he is, but I would take him all day in the second round.
Yeah.
Right.
Your last pick, Baylen Specter. I'm talking to my dad on the phone last night, and he lives down in Somerville, South Carolina.
Yeah.
He's like, you got one of the Bruise brothers. I was like, what? Because I hadn't heard
him
that.
And Skalski.
So, yeah, so I looked it up, and sure enough, that's what they called those two guys,
yeah.
The Bruise brothers. I know you said he certainly brings an edge to a defense. So mm-hmm. there ain't nothing wrong with a little bit of nasty. Like,
yeah. No, he's a versatile player. Similar type skill set to Bernard. You know, a versatile player. Run and chase, has played high-level football. You know, Clemson's had a really good program. They've been in the playoffs pretty much every year till this year. And so he's fun to watch. You know, again, a run and chase. He should help us on fourth down also. And I guess I said two nights ago, I'm excited about these late-round guys. I think we got some guys that are going to push hard for a roster spot.
Yeah, right. And then as the, you know, offseason wears on, going back to Rochester, going to get – a little bit back to normalcy for this training camp, right? I mean, you're gonna everybody's headed over there. You're gonna pick up and move the entire caravan, traveling circus all the way over there. It's gotta be looking forward to that in some way. I know training camp's training camp, but man, oh man,
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. It's a great setup. It's a great town. They embrace us. It's not too far away. You know, listen, like anything, there's always a little bit of I gotta go stay in a dorm room. I gotta do this. But when the guys get there. There's a lot of camaraderie. There's a lot of fun. And it takes pressure off if you've got obligations at home, taking kids to daycare or night feeds, wherever you are in your family plan. And even, listen to my wife, hey, honey, what time are you leaving? Can you stop by CVS and pick up prescription for me?
Yeah.
Like, I don't have to worry about any of that. And I know the players feel the same way.
Yeah. I went on a little bit of a rant last week because I was trying to watch some Pac-12 offensive players. You know, just YouTube videos and stuff. And I'm watching these tight ends, like Dulcich from UCLA, and I got angry because
you got to listen to him.
And I know, and I'm not asking you, you know, I know you got relationships that you got to maintain and everything with college coaches and all that stuff. But defense in the Pac-12, Brandon, I got to imagine that's got to make some evaluations on offensive players more challenging at times because – some of the defenses in that conference, it's like I'm watching guys catch balls. There's nobody else in the camera shot.
Yeah.
It's the kid catching the ball. There's nobody near him but green grass. How does that impact evaluation sometimes when they're playing in a conference where maybe the defense, for lack of a better term, is substandard?
Well, you have to do all of it. You have to listen. Christian Benford played at Villanova. That's a different level than Kyer Elam played at. And so it's an easier translation to see Kyer Elam playing in the NFL than it is Christian Benford who he's going against. So you're trying to find matchups. You're trying to find these guys that seen this where Senior Bowl, All-Star games help. And you're hoping at some point they played even maybe if, you know, there's only two games a year or three games a year that were, man, that was a legit game, a Pac-12 championship or whatever. Like, you're looking for those opportunities to see because it is – college scouting is much harder than pro scouting because you see guys every day going against their level of player. you can be just going against a weak opponent that week and you're just abusing them. And, right. and you're also grading the athletic traits. You're watching them come off the line, their build-up speed, their lateral quicks, their hand-eye, reading a defense to know whether or not to run themselves into coverage and know when to sit down in a zone. So there's still other things you can find out. But you're right. Sometimes, depending on the level of play, you have to kind of throw the defense out.
Yeah, because I know you guys rely on the tape maybe more than anything else. But if the tape's not I mean, there's always something you can get from it, as you just pointed out. But if the value of the competition isn't there, I got to believe it makes the evaluation tougher sometimes.
It definitely does.
Yeah.
What's next? What's on the agenda?
So we're filling out this rookie camp right now because, you know, we want to be able to go 11-on-11 out there, and you don't have enough with your draft picks and unsigned. So we're inviting some guys to rookie camp. We've got most of those out and just working, finalizing that. And then we'll work through any staffing changes if those were to occur in scouting. This is kind of the end of the scouting season, so we'll see how that works. And then after we get through this rookie camp, get our weekends back, hopefully see you in the golf course.
Yeah. is there anything to be done in scouting the USFL?
Yeah, we'll follow that because there's definitely guys. We love it when there's other leagues. We'll track that. And listen, we're going to continue to monitor what you said earlier, guys, that there's still free agents that didn't sign that were like, hey, I didn't get the contract I wanted. I'll just wait till after draft and find a team that didn't pick a player that, you know, at my position and sign for a lesser than they probably thought. But we're still monitoring that. We're not to 90. With the guys we've kind of have agreements on, we're around 80, 84, I think. So we still got six spots to, you know, by the time we get to St. John Fisher to kind of work our way up to.
Right. Brandon, good thanks stuff. For the Brandon, time, as always. We appreciate
great
it.
Draft, a lot of fun.
Yeah, good job.
Awesome. What's fun for us? I don't know.
No, you know what? Draft part's fun. It's there's some grueling times, but you get your feelings hurt here and there. But it was good.
Are you satisfied with the way the draft room's set up now? You've been doing it like – it's got to be like – honed, you got it dialed in now, right?
I mean, it's good. The guy, we've had so much continuity. I know we've lost Joe and Dan Morgan a year ago, but the other guys that have filled in have been here and seen the operation. This year we got to have everybody back. Last year it was 10 people. Obviously the year before was in my basement. Everybody was excited to be back in the room, and it was like old times.
Did Shane give you a call?
Oh, yeah, he messed with me. I messed with him. Obviously, I saw him on ESPN, so I was trying to blow his phone up. He got me back.
He was calling him during the wrap-up press conference. Yeah. He was buzzing his phone. It was pretty funny.
Good stuff.
Thanks again, Brandon.
Thanks,
we appreciate
Brandon.
The
awesome.
Time. All right, that's Bills GM Brandon Bean joining us here at the top of our Monday post-draft review. Plenty more coming your way next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back to One Bills Live post-draft edition. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you.
Oh, my gosh.
Good conversation there with GM Brandon Bean. I was trying to remember, and I probably should have asked Brandon this because he probably remembers better than I do. I don't think he's ever made a move as big as the one that he made.
You mean
for Khalil Shakir?
The number of spots, you mean?
20 spots, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's his – well – I guess if you count the steps in which he made his way up to 7 to get Josh,
right.
That is more. But in terms of a single trade move, because that was a couple of trades in a row, because he traded Cordy Glenn to go, even so, it's only 15 spots. He went from 22 to 12 and then traded up with Tampa Bay to go from 12 to 7. So in the end,
spots.
It was 15 spots, and it took two trades to get there.
Right.
20 spots for Khalil Shakir. And he reiterated it again here, Steve, because I know I mentioned this to you when you came in this morning, that after the draft was over and he was asked about Shakir, he said he could view him in this team's number 4 receiver role, where he's basically backing up all 3 spots. That was the same role, as he pointed out here 20 minutes ago,
right,
that Gabriel Davis held down as a rookie. That's some high praise right out of the chute.
Well, it speaks to their intelligence and their football awareness.
Well,
I mean, they got to know where to line up in every formation, where every guy is, and how and what they're supposed to be doing. It's a lot to know. It's a lot to learn. but that's what the guy's displayed in his intelligence. Yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult. There's so much going on for these young guys coming in. You think about a guy like Shakir comes in. You got to, I mean, you're trying to get to know guys,
mm-hmm.
new words. And, you know, you have some of the, you know, football is football, but you don't know what they call it, right? So it's what's far left to these guys could be over four kind of, you can just call it a different name, different formations. So you got to learn all that. Then you got to learn the assignments for the plays mm-hmm. for all the guys. And it's hard enough just to learn one guy and then forget about learning all that. Then you got to go out and compete against a high level, you know, against guys that were better than anybody you lined up on a day-to-day basis against. So there's a lot on your plate coming in. And for a guy like Gabe Davis did it and did it really well. We didn't know because, remember, we couldn't watch him.
Right.
We didn't know how important he was going to be.
And not only that, the thing we heard about Davis is, because I remember this, Brandon would talk about it. Brian Daboll would talk about it. Gabriel Davis is such an impressive rookie because he's wise beyond his years. And I get the sense that they feel that Khalil Shakir has similar processing skills of the scheme, of the concepts, and can very easily execute it on the field. They have that sense from him.
Right.
And you heard Brandon say, because I said he had to be sticking out on your board if you're going up 20 spots in the fifth round. And he said, we would have taken him with our fourth-round pick that they traded away to get Kyrie Elam.
Right, and that's, you know, it's interesting because back in 2020 when nobody was in the stadium watching these guys and it was Gabe's rookie season, opening day, first game, he's out there taking reps on the field live. I'm like,
Week one,
we were like, wow, look, well, why the MS like him? And sure enough, he has continued to – expand that role, and now you saw what happened in the last game. The Bills actually were on the field. The guy catched four touchdowns in a playoff game.
And I don't want to oversell and put too many expectations on Shakir, but I'm kind of hearing a lot of the same things from the Bills front office about Shakir that we kind of heard in the early going about Gabriel Davis. We'll see how it plays out on the field. That's what ultimately matters.
Right. Well, it's interesting, too, because it's going to be a different offensive coordinator, but it's, you know, Dorsey was here. Was he here? He was here in 20.
This is his fourth season.
They've seen these guys go through that, and they've got this, you know, they're going to have a protocol in place and some mile markers in place for what they want Shakir to be doing and how much they're getting out of him. It'll be interesting to see, too. I remember in training camp we heard rumblings, because nobody was watching, once again, during the pandemic, of Gabe Davis. We're working him here, and as soon as he masters that, then we're going to move him around. And we never heard anything, and certainly they started moving him around.
Yeah.
So we'll probably get a much closer view and a much more live view of how this process goes with Shakir than we ever did with Gabe Davis, even though it went so well with Gabe Davis.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a similar set of circumstances in terms of the pecking order, because you're talking back then when Gabe was a rookie, the top three receivers were Diggs, Brown, and Beasley.
Right.
And he was the four. And now, right now, at least on paper, it's Diggs, Davis, and Crowder, you would assume, in the slot, the veteran player.
Yeah, or McKenzie. It depends on how big a role they want to give McKenzie and how much they want to put on his plate.
Right.
Or how much he impressed him from last year. I mean, because, like we said it, Isaiah McKenzie could not have played better when he got the opportunity last year.
So we'll see how that shakes out. But talking about Shakir, like, in the running for the number four role
right out of
4 hours after they drafted him.
Well, listen, it's a room that's
impressive.
It's got Kumerow in it.
Hodgins.
Marquez Stevenson.
Yep.
They've got some guys in there.
And I'll say, you know, watching Hodgins.
Hodgins kinda, is big.
He's added some bulk to his frame. I think he knows speed is not how he wins. He wins with his deft route running, and I think he also knows if I can just get a little bit stronger and I can shield defenders better, that makes me a target you could be more confident in.
What happens is when you're playing and you're trying to release upper body strength, you know, it's all about explosion, so it's your bottom half, waist down, so you can, you know, your power plant and your legs and your quick feet and all that. But that's what gets you speed and gets you velocity and gets you in and out of breaks with some explosion that gives the quarterback some confidence that he leads you out there. You're going to be able to get out there and get it away from the defender. But at the release and at the top of routes, a little bit to a lesser extent, but the same, your upper body strength gives you freedom to move, to start to run. Because if a guy stays in front of you, you're trying to hand fight, you can't put your shoulders down and start running, right? Because you're hand fighting. Upper body strength at the release is really key. And guys don't see that at college, right? They don't get that kind of physical play a lot in college.
Right.
So when they get up here to the NFL, it's something they see. It's like, wow, when I start to shrug the guy off, he won't move.
Yeah.
I can't get him
off. I gotta get stronger.
Right. So you see a guy like Hodgins take that to heart, and he comes in a little bit more buff.
He is.
Same thing we've been saying with
Greg Rousseau. He's gigantic. He looks like a velociraptor.
He's
unbelievable.
He's as big as a dinosaur. I mean, the guy looks like he's in a movie. So you see these guys who are committed and understand, and you can – it's hard to do when you've had so much success like these young guys have. And this rookie class will be no different. When you look in the – it's a gift to look in the mirror and say, I'm not all of that. I got to do something, you know? Because a lot of these guys go, I'm good. I got this, you know? I was beaten up on I was beaten up on these dental students. How much different can it be? Yeah, you get up here.
It's a little different.
It's a little different. And it's hard to get your mind around looking yourself in the mirror and watching yourself on tape and saying, man, oh, man, I got some work to do.
I still have some faith in Hodgins. The thing that impressed me most when I remember back to watching his college tape, he separates with a deft route running style because, like I said, he's not quick twitch and he's not fast on the watch.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some subtlety to the way he runs his routes. And I got to tell you, he's one of the best double move guys I saw in his class that year.
Yeah, he's here for a reason. He's
still here.
Because, they don't hang on to you to save face. I mean, this is not a general manager or head coach or anybody that has to like, oh, wow, if we cut Isaiah Hodgins, we're going to look bad. They don't care. He's here because he's shown them something. Yeah. They got some hope for him. So we'll see.
Let's go to the phones at 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. You're welcome to join us there if you have any thoughts on the Bills 2022 draft class. And we lead off today with John in Brockport. John, what do you have for us? You're on One Bills Live.
I'd just like to know what your thought is. Do you think Josh Allen can throw the ball farther than Matt Ariza can kick it?
Oh.
Probably not.
Yeah, I'm going to say probably not.
Probably not. Now, he can throw it. He can throw it as far as Ariza can kick it on a more consistent basis. But when the best punt comes off Ariza's foot and the best throw comes off Josh's foot, Ariza's kick will go further.
I mean, Josh can throw it 70, legit. Ariza has a couple of 80-yard punts.
Yeah, there's a couple on his highlight. He's got
not
80,
some rollers.
He's got an 82-yarder that he kicks from his goal line. You know, the line of scrimmage was like on the 10. He steps up, boots it right from the goal line, and it lands on the 18-yard line at the other end.
Yeah, it's not a 40-yarder that rolls 30 yards.
No,
this is all in the air.
It landed on the 18-yard line. So, it goes to the punter. So, yeah, there you go.
And we didn't even talk to Brandon about that, and that'll be an interesting competition between him and Matt Hawk.
I'll say this. One of the things that Ariza does do, and whether you like it or not or whatever, we're seeing here watching him kick field goals as well. He does line drive some kicks. Some coaches don't like that. Some coaching staffs are against it. And I'll give you an example. When I played, Marv Levy and Bruce DeHaven, their philosophy was give me a punter who kicks it 40 yards at least with hang time, and I want every kick fair caught because we'll never give up a touchdown to a fair catch. We'll never risk it. But if we get 40 yards of field position, we'll take it. Now you'll find more coaching staffs willing to let their guys cover the kick and just say, hey, listen, if you can get a 65-yard punt and they return it 10 yards, we still get a 55-yard net, and we'll take the extra 15 yards. You know, they're trying to maximize field position as much as they can. And so there's that philosophy as well. I heard Ariza too on his call. He's left foot. He punts left footed, which we're all watching here on MSG. He's right handed. Punts left footed.
See, but that punt I just watched there, it looks like he dropped it out of his left hand.
Yes, that's right.
I want to watch that again.
Well, that's the thing. If you're punting, you have to drop it out of the same hand as your kickside, which means he's dropping it with his off hand.
Because I thought, oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
So it's a weak hand.
Because I thought when he said I'm right-handed, I thought that meant he drops it out of his right hand. No, he drops it out of his left hand.
You drop it out of your left hand. You have to because that's what, you know, it's where
your body mechanics. I got confused when he said that on the conference call.
And, you know, he said it too. He's when, you know, an old friend of mine, Darren Bennett, who is the punter for the Chargers, who is the guy.
Oh, he's Australian, right?
Yes, he's the guy who brought the Aussie kick to the NFL. And he was, and Darren Bennett was talking to Ariza's father and said, he's kicking left footed. Yeah. And his dad said, yeah, but he's right handed. He said, Darren Bennett just walked off. It's hard. It's hard to drop it because it's all in the drop for a punter.
Correct.
You got to put it on your foot correctly.
Otherwise, it's shankopotamus.
Right. And if you're doing it with a, you know, it's like doing everything left handed when you're a right handed person, it's hard to do it exactly right. So, it is an issue. Left-footed kicker, but he's right-handed. There's a ton of that in the NFL.
I don't
guys
know that
are
it was much
dominant.
Of an issue. I mean, he broke the gross punting record. It used to be held by Braden Mann, who was a sixth-round pick of the Jets a couple of years ago. He broke the NCAA record for that, 51.3. He broke the gross punting record.
Yeah, that's a big number by any standard.
I mean,
in NFL standards. It used to be. Brownie, when I played, nobody – it was like the Holy Grail. You couldn't net 40 yards for the season. Now maybe half the league does that.
It's about 14 punters.
Yeah, maybe half the league –
are above net 40.
Nets 40. That's how good they've gotten, you know. That's how good they've gotten. Ray Guy, if you put – and it's just like Joe Namath's numbers as a quarterback stacked up against the quarterbacks these days. Jim's numbers – Terry Bradshaw's numbers, Roger Staubach's numbers. You stack those up. Some of the metrics of how you do that. You stack up like Ray Guy's punting numbers with these guys, and it's not even a comparison.
Yeah, it's just different now.
It's just different now.
Ariza was also the Ray Guy Award winner. So
yeah,
best punter in the country.
And he was actually turned out to be the third guy taken.
Yes,
which he's gonna take
a little chip on his shoulder.
He's gonna chew that up, swallow it, and let it fester.
For those that did not see it, the jersey numbers for all of the draft choices are out. We will tell you who has what number in the eight members of the draft class when we return. Here on One Bills Live, presented by Kalida Health, it's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back to One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. As we mentioned, the jersey numbers have been assigned to Buffalo's 2022 draft class, and they are as follows in order in which they were selected by the Bills in the draft. Kair Elam is going to wear jersey number 24. James Cook is going to wear jersey number 28. Some thought he might choose number 4. But 4 was already taken by Jaquan Johnson, who changed from his jersey number 46 the last couple of years here in the offseason. Terrell Bernard, 43. Khalil Shakir, number 10. Matt Ariza, number 19, which is the highest number a punter could have. Christian Benford, the corner, 47. Luke Tenuta, 67. And Baylen Spector, the linebacker, 54. You can go to Buffalo Bills on Twitter if you need to see those numbers in jersey colors. They are there for you, as our MSG viewers are seeing right now. Nothing too outlandish there. I do remember, it wasn't too long ago, Steve, linebackers like shunned any number in the 40s. And it's become more commonplace now. I know Tremaine Edmonds has been 49 here for 4 years. But I still remember guys whining about the 40. Ah, 40 number makes you look fat. And it's terrible in a jersey.
Yeah, guys are getting used to it now. Now that they've liberalized the number of things, it's, you know, guys kind of pick their own.
Well, yeah, and you got single digits. And for those that haven't heard, you might be saying, well, how come Kyir Elam's getting 24? Isn't that Taron Johnson's number? Taron Johnson switched his number in the offseason to 7. So your nickel corner is going to be wearing 7 this year. That's going to be a weird thing, just seeing DBs running around in single digits. I mean, I know you see in the college game all the time because there are no number rules, but I think it's still going to be weird seeing Taron running around in a 7.
I think the only rules there are now are offensive linemen really can't be outside the 50s to the 70s, right? And then DBs, wideouts, all those can have numbers in the 20s, teens, and single digits in the 80s.
Right. I mean, O.J. Howard took number 8.
Yeah.
So it's going to be some numbers to get used to here. I mean, I know the rules went in last year, but I think it's for some of them it was too late to make the switch. Because if you try to make a switch after the deadline passes, the league mandates that that player has to buy out all the jersey inventory that the league has in stock. I mean, they could get up into the hundreds of thousands of dollars just to change your number. So most guys, if they miss the deadline, they just wait till the window opens again after the next season, which is what Taron Johnson did, changing from 24 to 7. A lot of corners lately wearing 24 on the Bills roster. You got Kyir Elam, then it was Taron Johnson before him. Was it Terrence McGee before that? I know he was 24. I just don't think there was anybody in between those guys.
Steph Gilmore, what did he wear?
Oh, he wore 24, you're right, after McGee left.
Right.
And then Leonard Johnson, who was the nickel corner before Taron Johnson.
Leonard Johnson.
The first year
good call there.
Under the McDermott regime, he wore 24. I think that's the order there. I think we did a pretty good job spinning that back about 10, 15 years.
Mm.
Number 24, popular number on the defensive side of the ball. At corner, you mentioned Luke Tenuta and the number he's got.
Yeah, Kent Hull's number 67 getting rolled back in. One of the legendary guys from the 90s passed away. But gave me pause for a second. He was a vital member of those teams and a well-loved guy.
So, and a Wall of Famer as well.
And a Wall of Famer.
So those are the jersey numbers for your 2022 Bills draft class. We heard Brandon Bean reference the undrafted Steve, and he did say they had about 9 that agreed to contracts. Now, those may still have to be physically signed, so they're not official yet. We probably won't find out about those until next week, right before rookie minicamp opens. So we await the official word on who the undrafted additions are to this roster as well. We have to take a break here, but when we come back, ESPN's Matt Bowen is going to join us. He has been crunching tape, much like his broadcast partner on the NFL matchup show on ESPN, Greg Cosell. So we'll get his thoughts on the Bills draft class and anything else that surprised him in the 2022 NFL draft next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio.
Tasker, who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual-role player for you.
Steve!
A balloon.
Steve! A blimp? We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy. Hour number 2 of our post-draft review. One Bills Live, Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you, and pleased to be joined now by ESPN NFL analyst and co-host of ESPN's NFL matchup show, also a former Bills safety back in 2006 and 7-year NFL veteran, Matt Bowen, joining us from the Windy City, or nearby anyway.
Hey, Matt.
Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you?
Good. So I want to start here because the general consensus going into the draft was, absent a quarterback class of star power, that this was going to be a pass rusher draft. And while that was certainly the case in round 1, and probably over a good portion of day 2 as well, I'm going to submit this to you, Matt. First 3 rounds of the draft, 17 pass rushers come off the board in the first 3 rounds. There were 20 receivers in the first three rounds. So people can talk about pass rushers all they want. End of the draft, Matt. 26 pass rushers go, 28 receivers drafted. What is that the headline of this draft? Because receivers have reshaped the market this offseason, and now you see 28 kids go off the board, 20 in the first three rounds.
And I'll tell you what, I think that's going to continue. When you look at the last couple classes, and what we're projecting for next year and the year after that, the talent at wide receiver is really deep. It starts younger. You know, you guys know I coached at the high school level here in Chicago. And passing offenses have exploded in high school. A lot of spreads, a lot of trips to the field. You're seeing more pro and college-style concepts in the high school game. And high school receivers are catching passes, a lot of passes, a lot different than when we were all in high school running split back veer, right? So everything is exploded. It transitions to the college level. You look at the college level, too, a place like Alabama, you're running pro-style routes at Alabama. A lot of colleges, you can say that about that. And then these receivers come to the NFL with more pro-ready traits, in my opinion, that can play right away. As you guys know, in Buffalo, most NFL offenses right now operate with three wide receivers on the field.
Right.
That's their base package. So you need three wide receivers there. You need five on your roster. You need a couple who can play special teams for you as well. And I think it's going to continue that way as we progress through future draft years because the talent is so deep and the development is so much more pro-ready.
How long is it going to be before corner catches up to it? Because now if you look at the supply and demand, corners should be way outstripping wide receivers. We still see Tyreek Hill sign a $30 million contract. There isn't a cornerback within shouting distance of that, although there's some well-paid ones. Corners are going to be at a premium because there are fewer of them that can really play at that level.
No, I agree with that. And I tell young kids all the time, if you have natural ball skills and you have good top-end speed, work on developing your footwork to play backwards, right? Because then you turn in terms of recruiting, in terms of playing college, in terms of getting drafted, like you said, Steve, there is going to be a more demand for corners, especially corners who have the long frames that can impact the ball at the point of attack, guys at the top end speed to recover down the field, and guys who have the hips and the fluid movement traits to open and run with wide receivers to open and squeeze inside. And I think you saw in this draft too, Steve, the importance of the safety position as well. You saw a lot of safeties drafted in day one and day two when you put that group together, because you can look here in Buffalo, and I've said this all the time throughout the draft process. If I'm building a secondary right now, the model for me in terms of having a safety with multi-dimensional traits is looking at the Buffalo Bills. That's how I want to build my defense. I want Micah Hyde and I want Jordan Poyer in my secondary because they're interchangeable. They can both cover. They can rotate to the post. They can spin down and play in the box. They can blitz and they can match up the tight ends. And most importantly, they tackle and they play with urgency. And you saw some safeties. I went through this class. Jaquan Brisker went to the Bears. Brian Cook from Cincinnati, who went to Kansas City. Those are the type of safeties I think that the NFL really wants now too, because they have that versatility, because they have to impact the passing game as well.
So let's begin. And speaking of corners with length, Kaiir Elam, Buffalo's top pick. I mean, Brandon Bean told us he was the last guy they had in round one with a first round grade. So that's why they went up two spots, because they didn't want to lose him. You know how much McDermott puts emphasis on run support with his corners. It looks like he can do that. I'm impressed that he's already mastered how to effectively use his length. He's got that reach around move and trail technique. I mean, he seems like a pretty advanced guy for a 21-year-old kid.
Yeah, and ultra competitive and plays with an aggressive style. You want someone who's physical, has the coverage traits, but ultimately someone who will challenge wide receivers. That's what you're going to get in this league every Sunday when you play. And I like to tape on Elam. He has traits. You know, when you talk about traits at the cornerback position, you mentioned some of them right there, Chris. He's 6'2". He's got sub-4.4 speed. He can play press. He's got good eyes and zone coverage. You're going to need that in Buffalo, because Buffalo is a very multiple defense, in my opinion. It doesn't get discussed about enough, because under McDermott, under Leslie Frazier, they'll play their split safety coverages. They'll play their single high coverages. They'll get into man. They'll pressure with man pressure. But you got to be able to do both. I think you get that with Elam, who has that first-round traits. And I'm not surprised at all he went in the first round. We start going throughout the draft process. There's a couple of names I thought for Buffalo at that spot. Obviously, Elam was one of them. Andrew Booth from Clemson. Kyler Gordon from Washington. Two corners right there who went on day two. But Elam has higher level traits and more upside in this league because of the size, because of the speed, and because of what he can do making plays in the football.
And one of the things we found out after the fact was that the pre-draft process, I mean, Elam came into his interview with the Buffalo Bills, and, I mean, he was a mature professional player who was ready for that interview. He talked about self-improvement, taking notes about what teams did against him, what receivers had success, why they had success, one things he could do. I mean, his note-taking ability and his command during the interview process, I mean, it just screamed exactly what the Buffalo Bills want in all of their players, let alone a cornerback who could be a number one cornerback in the near future.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I've said that before. If you're going to play for Sean McDermott's football team, you know, you need a high-level football character and a professional approach to what you do. And obviously I'm not in the building with you guys, but you can see it in the way people play. Okay, I've always said that. When you watch the tape, especially defensive tape, you can understand that there's an established defensive culture, an established defensive identity. There's no question Buffalo has that, and especially in the secondary. We already talked about Micah and Jordan, but also Tre'Davious White. And professionalism they play with, the technique they play with, the fundamentals they play with, their speed to the football, the way they tackle, that's all a part of it. And that's a great veteran room to put a young cornerback in because he's going to learn immediately from those veteran guys and learn how to play Buffalo Bills football.
Last one on Elam, Matt, because you mentioned his length and his size and his aggressiveness. We've seen the Bills over the last 3 or 4 years when they've had to play Kansas City every year. They've tried just about everybody under the sun on defense against Kelce in a matchup situation. They've tried Milano. They've tried Poyer. They've even put Tre'Davious White on him at times. Could Kaiir Elam, with his height and length and aggressiveness, be a potential option that might actually work against Kelce?
It's a great question, and I think it's a good idea because look at how other teams played Kansas City this year. I'll bring up one. Cincinnati, when they went to their dime, which is 6 defensive backs in the field, they used Trey Flowers, who's a corner, who's 6'3", and has got the length and can get aggressive with the tight end in terms of Travis Kelce at the line of scrimmage. So that could be an option when they do play their man coverages to put Elam on him. Because I'll tell you what, he's got the confidence and the competitive traits to do that in a one-on-one situation.
And then they came up in round two, pick number 63. They jumped up and got James Cook. Brownie and I really started talking about him that day, the Friday of the day two, but that before that night began, as a guy that all these receivers were getting taken. If there was a run on receiver, they weren't going to get one. Cook is a guy who is, and I know we make this, and I know it sounds crazy, but you know, to give people an idea of what his skill set was, we said, hey, this is a guy like Alvin Kamara who can line up as a wide receiver. He can take handoffs in the backfield, very nifty out of the backfield, can take the handoff and go between the tackles. Can outrun guys at the edge. As a real versatile running back with a big-time aspect of wide receiver in his game, we thought, both Brownie and I thought, man, this is a guy the Bills might grab. And certainly it ended up being that.
Yeah, and I agree. You're not comparing him in terms of the player profile to Alvin Kamara, but the deployment you are. And Greg Cosell and I really both like James Cook because of how you can deploy him in an NFL offense. I agree. Coming out of the backfield, he's going to create matchups against linebackers all day. There's no question whether it's running a choice or an angle route, bursting to the flat, what he can do after the catch in the screen game. But then you go through his tape at Georgia, and you'll see that they flexed him outside the formation. And that's where I think he can be really an offensive weapon for this football team. You can flex him to the slot. You can put him out wide. And, again, that gives you a tactical advantage from an offensive perspective. You walk that running back out there split wide to the backside of the front side of the formation. Someone's got to walk out there with them. You're going to find out real quickly who it is, if you like the matchup, and also it's going to tell you from a coverage tendency perspective what the defense is playing based on your formation. I think as a runner, you can feature him on perimeter schemes in the NFL. What does that mean? Toss, outside zone, some stretch schemes, because he's got the vision. He's got the short area burst to get up to the second level, and he can hit it now. He can hit it when he gets north and south. I love the pick, especially looking at offense like Buffalo, who I think is very QB-centric. What I mean by that, the offense is built through Josh Allen and what they do in terms of both the pass and the run game. Now you're adding another offensive weapon who has really dual threat ability at the running back position. that can create matchup advantages for your offense. I love the pick. Love it.
People were like, they didn't get a receiver until round five. And we'll talk about Shakir in a second because I think he's a sleeper in this class. But
I do too.
But Cook, who they take at the bottom of round two, I would argue he still fits the bill in terms of diversifying the Bills' passing game.
Well, look what they try to do during free agency.
Well, right.
You know, we saw it right
McKissick,
there.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to get McKissick. So they obviously wanted a running back with pass-catching traits. And not just a running back to run swings and unders, okay? That is fine at the running back position. But if you really want to threaten defenses, you want a running back who has pass-catching traits and really some wide receiver traits to his game based on deployment, based on formation and alignment. And that's what James Cook gives this offense.
I asked this question of Brandon Bean a minute ago. We've talked about positionless defensive players, you know, safeties, linebacker hybrids. On offense, you get guys like Deebo Samuels making a name for himself, you know, doing a lot of things, obviously having a wide receiver skill set, but then moving back, lining up in the backfield. It puts a lot of pressure on a defense to make decisions about who they're going to cover and how. And a guy like Alvin Kamara and like James Cook, you know, that seems to be maybe a trend on the offensive side as well, where you get a guy who can, you know, be a running back but have wide receiver skill set.
I agree. And, again, you mentioned Deebo Samuel, how he's utilized. Patterson in Atlanta as well. Don't forget about the pre-snap scheme touches, you know, the manufactured touches, right, where you can use James Cook on a fly sweep or a jet sweep. You can use him on a bubble screen. You can use him on a reverse. That gives your offense more options. That creates more stress for your defense. And again, where they are lining up doesn't necessarily mean how they're going to be utilized in that specific play.
All right, so flipping it over to the other side of the ball, Terrell Bernard, their third round pick, little undersized, but seems to have really good diagnosis skills, and I only worry about it if they can't, like, I'm not saying he's going to start this year. You got Tremaine Edmonds and Matt Milano, for goodness sakes, but you know, in the event that he gets on the, you know, on the field at linebacker, as long as they keep him clean, he's 100 tackles, it's a given.
Yeah, I agree with that. He's got sideline to sideline range, like I call it second level range. He can key diagnose the run game. I think he's got the foot quickness to match up with running backs out of the backfield. And you have to remember with Buffalo, no one in the NFL played more snaps of sub package in terms of having five defensive backs in the field last year than the Buffalo Bills. That was their base defense last year. Okay, so you start projecting for the future. I agree with you. He's not going to start over Milano and Edmonds this season. He's going to be a depth player for them this season. If someone misses a game or two, he can step in and be a starter. But immediately he helps you on special teams. Linebackers and defensive backs who you draft, especially on day two and day three, have to be impact special teams players for you. One that helps with development. Steve knows this better than anyone. You have to play at top speed. And I think that is the ultimate teaching tool. But in terms of what he can do defensively, when you're playing with two linebackers on the field, can he drop the hook, the curl, and close the football? Yes. Can he read it out and get a jump on the ball in terms of the run game? Yes. Can he match underneath to a running back? I believe he can. And then when you're talking about tight ends, and it's not necessarily true man coverage against a tight end, but can you get to that bottom hip, carry up the field on a seam route or a corner route when you have safety help over the top? I think he gives that to you as well. So that's a depth pick that fits what they want at the linebacker position. And I think it fits the modern-day linebacker position, having versatility to defend both the run and pass game and to be a core special teamer for you as well.
And then we get to what was really the most surprising pick by the Bills. They trade up 20 spots to get Khalil Shakir. Talk a little bit about what you think his skill set is. And, you know, Brandon Bean has already talked about, you know, how valuable they thought he is and was. They were going to get him with their fourth-round pick that they traded away to jump up. So talk a little bit about Khalil Shakir.
I think he's a football player. That's the best way to describe him, right? He can do a lot of different things for you. I don't remember what his 40 time is. I don't care. I don't have his exact measurables in front of me. Again, I don't care because you can turn on the tape and the guy consistently makes plays. I think he's tough. I think he plays with a physical element. He's got enough top-end speed to separate. He's got some nuance in terms of his route running ability. You look at Boise State, how he's utilized. He did everything for him. We're talking about James Cook, right, and how he can be deployed. Think about Shakur in that offense. He can run the fly speed sweeps. You can put him in the backfield to release underneath to create combination routes for your offense. I think he's tough. He'll work the dirty areas of the field. What I mean by that, that's between the numbers. And, Steve, you know, when you go between the numbers in the NFL, it can get a little tough in there. There's a lot of traffic to work through, a lot of bodies around there. I think he's a perfect fit for that, what they want to do in terms of middle-of-the-field throws, the ability to produce after the catch, what he's going to give you on special teams, because that's a guy I would immediately target if I'm the special teams coach in Buffalo and say, what can he do for us on our four core special teams? Because I know he's going to give max effort. And, again, I just go back to, I think he's a football player. You find places for those guys on your roster because you know they will compete, they will produce, they will block in the run game, they'll do everything that's asked of you. And he's got enough plays on his college tape, and he said this is going to transition to the NFL in the right system, and they put him in the right system in Buffalo.
Yeah, I mean, his time speed at the combine was 4.43, which is pretty good. He also has three siblings that all ran track in college. But as you mentioned, Matt, he was used all across the formation, and it's interesting that that's the case because being about 4 hours after drafting him in his press conference after the draft basically said they could envision him as their number four, basically backing up all three spots in the starting lineup. That was the same role they gave Gabe Davis as a rookie. So once I heard that, my ears perked up a lot. I mean, they just drafted the kid 4 hours ago. I think it just speaks to what they believe his processing and his football IQ is, right?
I do 100%. Any wide receiver who can play all three spots, you have to have very high-level football IQ. There's no question about it. Because the demands put on you to know every spot. And again, that goes back to versatility. I use the term multidimensional traits when talking about the secondary earlier in the show. But that applies to every position, especially skill position. And with Shakur, you're talking about someone who has multidimensional ability within your offense where he can play the X, he can play the Z, you can put him inside in the slot. And then we talked earlier about the creativity he can bring in terms of the manufactured or scheme touches. You find ways to get players like that. You want the football in their hands. And you work extra as a coach to come up with creative schemes to do that.
Can we infer anything from all of these wide receivers being taken, and really not just in this last draft, as Brownie alluded to, there are more receivers taken than any other position virtually. And the last three drafts have been the same. I mean, they've been wide receiver heavy. Teams are getting immediate impact from their wide receivers. And Brownie's made the point as well. There were like six or seven teams last year that carried six or seven receivers on game day.
Or at least on their 53-man roster.
And certainly on their 53-man roster. Mm-hmm. Do you sense a trend that way of maybe on game days more and more teams just saying, forget it, we're spreading them out and we're going to deal with the pass protection by getting rid of the ball quick because, you know, everybody's kind of getting rid of it quick now anyway. Are they just going to say, listen, let's give our guy more options and spread the defense out so it's easier to read? What do you think about the trend and maybe the evolution of the game going that way and maybe too far that way?
I don't know if it's going to go too far that way. You bring up a good point because the last couple of years on the matchup show, when we went through the draft process, and yes, you have your boundary X wide receivers, right? You're going to have your X wide receiver. You're going to have your Z in your slot. We talked about that. But the wide receivers now that are more versatile, like Shakur, we call them motion movement targets. Okay, and motion movement targets are the players that can play a couple different wide receiver spots. They have that flexibility where you can give them handoffs in the backfield. You can get them loose on screens and jet sweeps as well. So I think that's part of that, Steve, is you're having more versatile players at the position. You're carrying more in your roster. The one thing I would say is you can't forget about special teams. So you have to have wide receivers that can also cover kicks, you know, that can play gunner, can be a jammer outside, can block on the front line of kickoff return, or have dynamic ability as a returner. If I'm building a roster, yes, I want it to be deep at wide receiver. But once I get past really wide receiver four, if I'm going to carry six, the number five and six better be very high-level special teams producers for me as well. But I do think the league is trending to where – it's going to be 11 personnel. We're seeing more 10 personnel. We've seen it in Buffalo before when you have four wide receivers in the field. So, yes, the game is getting more spread out, and that goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the safeties and the corners. How you counter that, you have to have versatile players there as well.
Talking with ESPN NFL analyst Matt Bowen, last one I've got for you, Matt. concerns the corner from the small program, Villanova, Christian Benford, FCS level. But, you know, when you're looking at a smaller school kid, you want to see him stand out. He did in terms of the accolades he received. What is it about his game that you think is going to give him a shot at the NFL level?
You bring a great point about someone at a lower level. You look for size, traits, and production, right? You expect him to make plays. If he's going to be an NFL draft pick and he's playing at a lower level, he should stand out when you watch out the tape. It should be a couple of plays. You say that guy looks like an NFL prospect. And I think you saw that with him. A lot of on-the-ball production. And what I mean by on-the-ball production, guys that make – everyone talks about interceptions. I understand that. He had a bunch of PBUs last year on his college tape. Obviously, he had the interceptions. He's another corner, guys, who's 6 foot plus, right? And that's, like we talked about, where the league is trending. You want corners that have some length, one, to be able to play press, but two is to make plays in the football. And when you're a long corner and you're breaking, let's say, you know, a 15-yard in-breaker and you're funneling it from outside in, you have to have that long reach and that long frame to make a play on the ball. If you don't, you can secure the tackle and go on to the next play. And that, sometimes you need that. But you have to be able to make plays in the football. On his tape, he made a bunch of plays. So I go back to the size, the traits he has to play in a pro secondary, especially in this Bills secondary, and plus the production he put on tape and how he looks on tape. You see, that's a draftable prospect. And I think he went in the range where I expected him to. And that's another depth move from Buffalo. And I've always said this. Steve, you mentioned wide receiver. I don't think you can ever have too many defensive backs.
Right.
I don't.
Right.
With the amount of sub-package that Buffalo plays, playing an extra game in the season, what they provide in terms of being a fifth or sixth defensive back on the field, but also your special teams unit, you can never have enough defensive backs. Never, because matchups change. Matchups change. We talked about earlier with Elam. Could he be a tight end matchup player? Well, when you draft young players, you start to think about that. You know, are they exclusively an outside corner? Can we play them inside? Is there a certain tight end that they can match up to? Is it a flex tight end that always plays in the slot that we can match them up to? And then you start to develop them in a veteran defensive back room. I think it's a really strong pick and someone that you can grow within your own system.
How likely is it that a player, and we talked about it a lot in the lead up, this is a really deep and talented roster in Buffalo. The expectations in Buffalo this year are higher than any team in the league. They are absolutely expected to go to and compete for the Super Bowl. How likely is it that, you know, guys like James Cook and Elam, all these guys, Terrell Bernard, Khalil Shakir, Matt Araiza, certainly Araiza will probably be on the 53. How likely is it that the guys behind those guys, you know, the Christian Benfords of the world, will be on this roster, at least on the 53-man roster? Certainly they're all candidates for the practice squad. But how hard is it? I mean, you've seen it. Good teams, it's hard to make 53-man rosters.
It is, but that's what you want, right, Steve? You want competition at every position. And I agree with you on the expectations. When the team goes out and signs Von Miller, okay, that tells me that you are putting together a team to beat Patrick Mahomes, to beat all the high-level quarterbacks in the AFC because you believe you have a win-now roster that can win the Super Bowl. If I'm making a pick right now, and again, we're not – even in really in mini camps or OTAs, but if I'm making a pick right now for the AFC, there's no question it's the Buffalo Bills. There's no question. Based on what Josh did last year, and I know they didn't get the win against Kansas City, but I thought that game for Josh was the defining game of his career so far. Defining game. Because that put him in the group. But, you know, it's also the entire season of tape. But that game right there, I said, Josh Allen's a scheme-transcendent quarterback. What I mean by that, someone that can function and produce in any offense you want to design around him, he can do it. That's up there with Patrick Mahomes. That's up there with Aaron Rodgers, that level of play. And then you add Von Miller, you go to this draft class right now that will make it even more competitive. And that's what you want. You want to draft guys that can come in and push veterans for playing time immediately because that's going to make training camp this much more competitive environment, much more high-level energy environment. And then you have better practices. You can have more competition to get on the field in the preseason games. And you're going to build a stronger roster because you're going to need that roster to get through 17 games. And when you get to the postseason tournament, that AFC is loaded. It is loaded. So you're going to need as much depth as you can.
Matt, thanks for all the insight. We appreciate it. We'll catch up with you down the line, all right?
Thanks, Matt.
All right, guys. Thank you very much. Go Bills.
Yeah, indeed. Man. ESPN NFL analyst Matt Bowen joining us here with his post-draft review, not only of the draft at large, but the Bills class as well. We take a break here, but when we come back, we will get some of your thoughts on the tweet sheet where we're asking you, how would you grade the Bills 2022 draft class and why? That's coming up next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kalata Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. Welcome back. Time for your grade for the Bills 2022 draft class and why. And we go to the tweet sheet for those answers, brought to you by Corrigan Moving Systems, the official equipment moving company of the Buffalo Bills. And Jeremy leads us off, and he says, I would say this draft is an A-. Love, love, love the top two picks. I'm unsure of pick three, and the rest of the class is solid. Love the punt god.
You know why he loves the punt god? Because the guy's got a nickname.
That's right. But, Steve, your theory about the power of having a nickname on your draft stock took a bit of a hit this weekend.
A little bit of a hit, but I don't think...
Because Punt God had a nickname, and he's the third punter.
I know, but it's not like a...
Jordan Stout and Jake Camardo went before him.
Right. I'm not sure that, you know, Punt God is really all that good a nickname.
I think it's
got to be a catchy nickname, and I know there's a gray area there.
There is another one out there for Matt Araiza. I don't know if you've seen it.
No.
Legatron.
Well, see, now, if it was Legatron, the guy goes, is the first punter taken.
So
I'm
it's the quality of the nickname in addition to.
Yes, absolutely. Just okay. Have it any old nickname. If it's catchy and da-da-da-da-da and all that, it certainly, absolutely boosts your stock draft. Look at this guy didn't even call him Arise. He calls him the punk god. He loves him. So but
I do think Legatron is a stronger nickname.
It is. Legatron is way stronger,
isn't it?
Than the punt god.
Yeah. It's a winner all the way.
All the way.
William says, I give him a B-. I think they were too indecisive in the second round. Yeah, they landed a pretty good running back prospect, but I don't think he was the prospect they were after. Trading the fourth to move up in the first round, I think, hurt them a little bit on day three. All right, so let's dissect this, because there's a lot to unpack in that comment. Number one, it's not a matter of being indecisive in the second round. Brandon Bean was on with us last hour, but he explained this morning with Jeremy on WGR that the reason they traded down twice was for this reason. They were sitting there at 57, and they had five players they were comfortable drafting at 57. So they said, let's try to get some picks back. We just lost our fourth with the trade up in the first round. Let's slide back, get some more draft capital, because we know with five guys we like on the board right now,
we're going to get one.
We move back three picks later, we're still getting one of them.
Right.
So they slide back to 60. When they get to their pick at 60, those five guys are still all on the board.
Right.
None of them have gone.
Right.
So they say, let's move back again and get some more draft capital. You heard Brandon here on our show last hour say, hey, we kind of liked the value at the back end of the draft, so if we can get some extra sixes or something, let's move back again. So they move back another three spots, and then at that point, between pick 60 and pick 63, one of the guys that they had on their list of five did come off the board, and that's when Brandon said, let's not get too cute here, let's take Cook.
Right.
And so there was no indecision there. It was a matter of having a multitude of options and being able to accumulate draft capital while still being able to get a guy they liked at that spot. As for your second contention, trading the fourth to move up in the first round hurt them a little bit on day three. If you just heard what Brandon Bean said here on our show at the top,
they would
have Khalil Shakir, who they took in the fifth round and moved up 20 spots to get, they would have taken the fourth round.
Yeah, they would have taken him in the fourth.
So no harm done.
It ended up not hurting them because they would have taken him had he been available at the what spot was it? The 80 or the one?
They had pick 130 in round four.
They would have taken him at 130 rather than 140 or
148.
148, yes. So they in essence moved up the four spots to drop down 18 spots and get their same get the same guy in the fifth round. So I will say this. You don't care about, particularly given the fact that you got a guy you would have taken anyway with the pick you traded, if
James Cook turns out to be the guy, nobody's going to care. You traded up four, you know, you traded up 20 spots to get him, or they were traded back three times to get him and picked up those spots. It's impossible to evaluate how well or how bad it went. You can only say how you feel about how it went today. Even Brandon Bean is, you know, they got to feel good about the guys they got. They got the right ones at the right time. They actually got out a little break when Shakir fell to them at 148. They felt really good about that. So they could cruise on the way through the rest of the draft. Got a punter, the whole kit and caboodle. But it's only a great draft if all these guys end up being really good.
Well, true.
You know?
Well, the going
– You do the best you can. It looks okay, but
– They say if you get three starters out of every draft class, not right away, if like after 2 or 3 years, if you have three starters out of that draft class, you're doing pretty good. If you have four, it's like hitting a grand slam.
Right. If you hit four, that's kind of a magic number. The Bills have gotten had drafts where they've gotten contributions and picked really good players – even at a higher rate than that, the 18 or the 17 draft, for instance.
17
Those draft. Guys, six or seven of them are still in the league. And there's a couple of all pros in there. Not all of them. You know, obviously the Wyatt Teller is an all pro for the Browns, but man, oh man.
Yeah.
They've had some good draft history here.
Seth on the tweet sheet says, just give him an A. Got the guy we needed in Elam, and I believe he has a higher ceiling than 27 did coming in. Cook and Shakir could prove to be stars, solid contributors as rookies at least, like the linebacker picks for special teams and, of course, the punt god. Benford will push Dane for CB3, seems to be a ball hawk. All right, so first, pretty bold statement there. Kaiir Elam has a higher ceiling coming in than Tre'Davious White, who started from day one. Now, where Elam has Tre'Davious...
You're talking raw data, but yeah.
Where Elam has Tre'Davious is in height, length, and speed.
Right.
He is taller, longer, and faster. So those physical traits probably do give him a higher ceiling. Now, it's up to him as to what he does with it, but you heard Brandon Bean, after he drafted him on night one, he said, Kaiir has a similar personality and approach to the game as Tre'Davious. If that's the case, he could be something special.
Absolutely. He's got the raw talent and the physical abilities to have, you know, there is no hot top end, right? I mean, he's big, long, strong, really fast, and he's committed, smart, really articulate, professional at a young age, mature at a young age. If you get a chance to go look at the embedded, Bills fans will go, you know, spend some time on the Bills website, go to the embedded thing and watch the behind-the-scenes interview combine that the Bills did, the combine interview they did with Elam. I mean, if you don't know that he's going to be a Bill after that, you haven't been paying attention. I mean, he said all the right things. And they all came across as being uncoached, genuine, and, hey, this is where I'm at. That's an interview that it could not have gone better. If a Bills fan watches that, you're all taking him. You're all drafting him. So his athleticism, I mean, we had the thing. He was the guy that was the toolsy one. Do you take a toolsy guy or a scheme fit? This is the guy they took was toolsy.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anything about his character, his work ethic, the note-taking he does, the film study, the self-evaluation. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I mean.
It's the total package.
Yes. He is everything, to me, coming out of Florida rather than LSU, he's everything Tre'Davious White was when they drafted him.
Mm-hmm.
And they got him at 23 rather than Tre'Davious was 18.
27.
27.
Yeah. Tre'Davious was 27.
So there you go. There's a lot of reasons to be really high on Kaiir.
He also said Cook and Shakir could prove to be stars, solid contributors as rookies at least. I would agree with that. He likes the linebackers for special teams. Yeah. And he thinks Benford will push for a roster spot. I don't know if he's going to push Dane Jackson for CB3, but I could see him pushing for a roster spot against the likes of Cam Lewis, Nick McLeod, you know, those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
I could see him doing that. I mean, as we just talked about with Matt Bowen, when you're playing FCS level football, you better have some impressive production. 41 pass breakups and 14 picks. That's pretty good.
Pretty impressive.
Now,
it's impressive.
So
those are unbelievable numbers.
And the best part about him is he's got the size. He's 6 feet. He's 192. I mean, he's just as big as Kair almost.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't run as fast. He's like a 4.5 guy, but he's got production. So he's going to be fun to watch as kind of an underdog in camp, you know?
And he's right. I mean, you've got to think Elam and Cook, they're going to be on the field taking snaps in games.
Oh, yeah.
And the ball's going to go to Cook, and it'll probably go to Elam as well. They're going to be on at the point. So, yeah, you're going to get to know these guys. That's those top two guys for sure.
Christopher says, Matt Ariza and Matt Hawk should be fun with Matt Smiley as the special teams coordinator. We're definitely going to the mat, but the most fun camp battle might be, can Ariza punt farther than Allen can throw? People are obsessed with this now. Overall, great draft. Can't wait to see this team come together.
Yeah.
How about Ken Dorsey? All the new toys he's got.
Yeah, it'll be fun for him to put that together. And you know, he's in a tough spot.
Is he?
Yeah. The pressure's on.
Well,
they can't stumble.
I guess
I get it
with the pressure.
There is no excuse, absolutely no excuse for them not to be one of the top scoring teams, offenses in the league, period. And if they aren't, there's no place else to lay the blame to but at the feet of the offensive coordinator.
Well,
I mean, that's just
because of what they did the last
year. Whether it's
two
true
years.
Or not. I mean, he could, you know, it might be injuries, could be a million things. We've all seen it. But man, oh man, at this point.
Yeah. I'm just thinking of all the personnel packages they could throw out on the field and you don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Like we were just talking about with Brandon. You put 22 personnel out there with Cook and Singletary in the backfield and you put Knox and Howard at tight end.
Yeah.
It could be a power formation conceivably.
Right.
So if you're putting linebackers on the field, now you split Cook out, you're hosed, dude.
Well, if you split Cook out or split O.J. Howard out.
Knox.
You forget how athletic Howard is can scoot. Yeah, it's a problem.
It's a matchup nightmare.
It's a problem.
It really is.
I'm sure that the scouting report on O.J. Howard, I mean, he's been a little bit nicked up over the last couple of years, and that's, you know, the Bucs brought in Gronk, and Brady has a lot to say about that, and I get it. So maybe he got squeezed out. But, man, oh, man, coming out of Alabama as a rookie, O.J. Howard was sought out. He was lights out measurables.
Mm-hmm.
You heard Josh Allen, and he's a big dude. And not only is he a big dude, he's athletic, he's fast. So it'll be interesting to see how they use him.
We will take a break here. When we come back, we'll take a minute to assess the AFC East post-draft. Jets had a lot of picks, made a lot of good ones. What did the Dolphins do, and where might the Patriots end up in the division this year after what they did? Woof, with a capital W. We'll get to that when we return here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, so in assessing the rest of the AFC East in the draft, I would say of the three other teams in the division, the Jets were the clear winner. Now, granted, they had about 12 picks to use, but they come out of the draft with one of the best corners in the class, one of the best receivers in the class. I know you're going to argue this, but one of the better pass rushers in the class and the top running back in the class. They also get a decent tight end in Jeremy Ruckert. The Long Island kid goes to play for his hometown team. And then they finish up with a tackle and another pass rusher late. But their top four draft choices are going to be on the field a ton.
Oh, yeah. As you would expect.
Yes, because roster isn't as strong as, say, a Bills roster.
And they, they traded back into the first to get the pass rusher.
Yeah, Jermaine Johnson.
The Jets were busy. And it's interesting, too, because it's so unusual. And it's so, you know, you kind of get used to it. A little bit of it's a little overdone. But the Jets have struggled in the draft. Yeah. They've done some stuff that is like the Patriots did, you know?
Joe Douglas did a nice job.
I thought he did, too. You got to admit it.
And made the most of the Jamal Adams trade.
Yeah, they are really reaping some benefits from that. So, even Bills fans who, you know, could not possibly care less or wish worse things on the Jets than they do, you got to admit, they got it together. And you can either it's Joe Douglas and Robert Saleh, and the way they draft and the way they're looking at things is completely different than the way it has been. But, man, oh, man, it's hard to poke holes in what they did because they're in the same boat as everybody else. You get to a certain spot.
Yeah.
You got to pick somebody or you got to trade out. And if you can't trade out, well, there you go. You got to make the pick.
Dolphins didn't do a whole lot since they made the Tyreek Hill trade. They didn't have a one or a two. They did take Channing Tindall in the third round. As for the Patriots, what are they doing? I'm just going to say this right now. With the way these teams are going, New England's going down. They might be in last place. We'll see you tomorrow.